This story dominates the news for about a week or two. And then no matter how horrible it is, something else happens and we move on.
But the early coverage of the Newtown Massacre has created dangerous myths that will endure. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. One of those myths is the connection between the shooter's alleged autism and his crime.
There's absolutely no association between autism and acts of premeditated violence, such as those that we saw in Newtown.
And Congress's in-house think tank, the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service, had to tweak the language in a report when confronted with charges of bias.
Instead of Bush tax cuts, we now see Bush era tax cuts. Instead of millionaires, we see high-income taxpayers.
All that and a whole lot more coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield. We've become accustomed in the past 20 years to seeing the issue of guns in America broken down into two camps. Gun control advocates, led by police chiefs and Sarah Brady, against the all-powerful National Rifle Association, which not only asserts a Second Amendment guarantee of gun ownership, but uses its vast war chest to elect sympathetic politicians and defeat opponents. But according to Adam Winkler, UCLA law professor and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, there was a time, relatively recently in fact, when the NRA supported gun control legislation and the staunchest defenders of so-called gun rights were on the radical left. That piece has been excerpted in The Atlantic. Adam, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
I'm old enough to remember when the NRA was substantially an organization that promoted marksmanship and hunter safety. And I've seen some of this evolution, but I was genuinely stunned at recent history, which had somehow escaped me. Mainly the origin of the gun rights movement in California in the 60s.
One of the surprising things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that when the Black Panthers started carrying their guns around in Oakland, California in the late 1960s, it inspired a new wave of gun control laws. It was these laws that ironically sparked a backlash among rural white conservatives who were concerned that government was coming to get their guns next. The NRA mimicked many of the policy positions of the Black Panthers, who viewed guns not just as a matter of protection for the home, but something you should be able to have out on the street, and also protection against a hostile government that was tyrannical and disrespectful of people's rights.
There was an incident with a traffic stop. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were sitting in a car, lightly armed.
They refused to give up their firearms. Huey Newton had gone to law school for a short time and had learned that in California it was lawful for him to be carrying loaded weapons as long as he carried them openly. In fact, the most dramatic incident was when the Black Panthers, 30 of them, showed up at the California State Capitol armed with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotgun and marched right into the legislative chamber while it was in session. In fact, they were debating a gun control law and the Panthers were there not to do violence, but to protest this gun control law.
This episode freaked out conservative politicians, including the governor of California, who could not for the life of him imagine a situation where a lawful American would want to carry a loaded weapon in public. What was the name of that governor?
That was Ronald Reagan, who would go on to become the first presidential candidate ever endorsed by the NRA. And of course, his politics did shift. He was an astute political strategist, and he understood by 1980 that he needed to support gun rights to keep his new right coalition together. And he was such an opponent of gun control when he was in office that even after he was the victim of an assassination attempt, he pushed for no new restrictive gun laws.
So tell me more about the origins of the National Rifle Association, and when did they become radicalized along Second Amendment lines?
The NRA was formed right after the Civil War by two former Union soldiers who were convinced that it was the poor marksmanship of Union soldiers that had allowed the war to go on so long. In the 1920s and 1930s, the NRA was a supporter of gun control, pushing states to adopt restrictive laws on concealed carry of firearms. In the 1960s and 70s, a series of assassinations like Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the race riots and the Black Panthers all led to a new wave of gun control laws. The NRA became divided between those who thought guns were primarily about hunting and recreation and those who thought guns were about personal protection against criminals in urban environments. Those hardliners ended up staging a coup at the annual membership meeting one year and replaced the entire leadership of the NRA with a group of hardliners who were committed to fighting gun control at all costs.
This was a schism that occurred at a point when the existing leadership of the NRA really wanted to move out west and focus on hunting.
That's right. Think of how different politics in America would be had the leaders of the NRA in the early 1970s carried through with their plan to retreat from political activity, move to Colorado Springs, and focus the organization on outdoors activities. That didn't happen, of course, and the NRA became committed to a very extreme view of the Second Amendment that really fought against any new gun control proposals under the theory that any new law was a slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. And that view has really shaped gun rights in America ever since.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, which was excerpted in The Atlantic. Friday morning, after a week of silence, the NRA held a press conference at which it took no questions but did assign blame for the massacre at Newtown. It was largely the media's fault. Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre singled out violent movies and video games.
Too many in the national media, their corporate owners, and their stockholders act as silent enablers, if not complicit co-conspirators.
LaPierre's proposed solution for school violence? Armed security nationwide to confront future assailants.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
We'll follow the lesser-known history of the NRA with another story many of us think we already know, but don't. In his book, Columbine, Dave Cullen revisited that soul-shattering school shooting 13 years ago and found that our memory of that event is largely frozen in early misreporting.
Two loner, outcast goths from the Trenchcoat Mafia went on a revenge slaying where they targeted jocks specifically to pay them back for years of relentless bullying. Everything that I just said is wrong. There was no targeting of jocks. They weren't loners or outcasts. They, you know, had lots of friends. So all of that was wrong. We came to that conclusion within a few days, and it stuck, and almost everyone still believes it.
The term trench coat mafia stands out for me.
Sure. One of the things that I talked about in the book is how all the myths have at least a kernel of truth. So there was a group called the Trenchcoat Mafia a year earlier, and they were friends with a lot of the same kids of Eric and Dylan. Eric and Dylan weren't really part of the group, but they were close, and Eric and Dylan did wear trench coats, so it all seemed to fit. It's like, ah, trench coats on them. There was a group like that. They had a few jocks, and we were putting things together and creating imaginary pictures, and in this case, we were way off.
How did we not arrive for all of the information that has come out in the intervening 13 years at a much more accurate and nuanced version of the story?
This story dominates the news for about a week or two. And then no matter how horrible it is, something else happens and we move on. Believe it or not, after Columbine, it lasted about 2 weeks. And then there was one day where there was a huge series of tornadoes in Oklahoma. And the national press literally left, not overnight, but over about an hour, and went to Oklahoma. It's boom. There's just sort of a particular day where it stops. And there will be one day when this one stops. Whatever day that is, any misunderstandings on that day will be with us forever.
There's one particularly unsettling bit of myth. It concerned one of the victims, a girl named Cassie Bernal.
The story that we knew it at the time was this poor young girl was hiding under a table in the library. Eric came up to the table and asked if she believed in God. She said yes, and he shot, and she died. Very quickly, within a few days, pastors picked it up, magazines, it was in all the mainstream press, and she became this heroic martyr figure who professed her belief in God.
It's easy for the public to imagine a proud martyr than a hapless victim.
Exactly. What actually happened was in another part of the room, Dylan Klebold shot several people with a shotgun, including a girl named Val Schnurr. She eventually tried crawling away, and he saw her and stopped her and started taunting her. Do you believe in God? And actually had a conversation. She said, yes. He asked her why. She said, because that's how my parents raised me. Then he got distracted, so he just walked away. He didn't really care about her, so he just let her go. She ended up living. She was rushed to the hospital, and unbeknownst to her, while she was in surgery, one of the other students in the library made a mistake and for some reason thought it was Cassie. And the word spread shortly thereafter. It was determined that Cassie had died, hence the martyr was born. Meanwhile, Val, she was ridiculed, and people in her own church even, you know, came up to her and derided her for trying to take over some heroine's story and use it for her own.
So powerful is the desire to find meaning in the face of the horrific, that even when we find the truth, we'll reject it in favor of the myth that's more comforting?
Some people will, including the youth pastor at her church, who famously said to Hannah Rosen at the Washington Post something like, the church will never change our story.
All right, now, we began this conversation by you capsulizing the public's notion of Columbine. Tell me, to the best of your understanding as the author of Columbine, what was in the heads of these kids when they murdered their classmates?
Well, the main thing to remember about Columbine is we've got two killers here, and they were polar opposites. So Eric Harris was the driving force of the plan, and he was a sadistic psychopath, which is someone with no empathy, no regard for the feelings of other people, and who in fact enjoys inflicting pain. He was paired with Dylan Klebold, suicidally depressed, distraught, considering suicide for 2 years. And Dylan is the model of what we most often see in these types of killers, someone who has gotten to such a point of hopelessness that they're ready to lash out and do something horrible and dramatic. And that's what we saw there.
Now, it's obvious that bad reporting can yield false understanding that can yield bad public policy. In this case, sketchy reporting led to false understanding, which led to good public policy. I'm talking about anti-bullying policies in schools and so forth.
It's actually one of the great joys of my life to see this anti-bullying campaign that has come out in the wake of Columbine. I was bullied as a kid, and I've seen so many kids who are bullied, but I still feel the need to stand up for the truth and say, yes, we should be doing this, but we're doing it for a mistaken reason.
Dave, many thanks.
Thank you very much.
Reporter Dave Cullen is the author of the book Columbine. Coming up, why journalists suffer from such clinical confusion when it comes to reporting on mental health and violence. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Once Adam Lanza had been correctly identified as the shooter, speculation quickly turned to why he had killed so many. Particularly bandied about was whether Lanza had been diagnosed with either a personality disorder or Asperger's syndrome, a condition on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum associated with extreme social awkwardness.
If he had something called Asperger's, he may have had ongoing meltdowns.
People are going to look at how we treat people we know have some sort of a mental disease or defect.
Of autism, according to a law enforcement official who spoke on the condition of anonymity, that could be very significant.
Curtis Brainerd covers science journalism for the Columbia Journalism Review. He says the media were not only wrong, but dangerously so when they linked the Newtown massacre to autism.
There's absolutely no association between autism and acts of premeditated violence, such as those that we saw in Newtown.
And yet, in a vacuum of information, any detail that the press gloms on, accurate or not, tends to take on all sorts of significance out of proportion to itself.
The public, the media themselves, are looking to grasp onto anything that they can to understand why somebody like Lanza or like any other number of mass killers out there could have done what they done. And often that quickly becomes the mental state of the shooter. We saw it after the shootings in Tucson, Arizona. We saw it after the shootings in Aurora, Colorado, in which Joe Scarborough speculated that James Holmes, who committed those murders, probably had autism. And I believe just a day or two later, Scarborough had to get back on the air and apologize.
There was an early report that showed up on Fox News Channel and TheAtlantic.com that referred to an ABC News report that Ryan Lanza, the shooter's brother, had told authorities that Adam had Asperger's and some sort of undetermined personality disorder. But weirdly, if you follow that back to the source, a timeline on an ABC News blog, there's no evidence of that report. Do you know whether what we saw was a false sourcing to an unsourced report to begin with, or whether ABC actually expunged the item from its timeline?
It's a very good question. It's not altogether uncommon when you have a sort of live blog report like they were running for updates to get deleted out as they are subsequently disproven. This is kind of one of the perils in our instantaneous media system. I have no way of knowing whether or not that's what happened with this ABC News report.
Do you think it's the association people make between the archetypal loner and the awkward Asperger's case that makes this such an apparently fetching fact for the press to transmit?
Journalists are absolutely latching on to some of the symptoms of autism and extrapolating to make them fit this profile that we have of the loner gunman, the social reject who one day snaps. But that's a really far leap that journalists are making and is just totally irresponsible and uncalled for.
In the early days of HIV/AIDS, there was all sorts of irrational fear about exposure to people who are HIV positive and people pulling their kids out of school. Exactly those kinds of unsubstantiated fears that the autism community worries about now. Should they be worried?
They absolutely should be worried. Because of the coverage that's already gone by, some people will forever associate this incident with autism. National surveys have shown that the media consistently overreport dangerous angles associated with mental illness. Other surveys have shown that this takes its toll within the public at large, where many Americans have very badly misconstrued ideas about the connections between people with mental illness and violence. There are very severe risks for not only the mentally ill, but for people who just are a little bit socially awkward. If the media get too carried away with this, people will start looking suspiciously at any kid in high school who keeps to himself.
Now, you've observed that there was one news organization that did everything exactly right.
The Poughkeepsie Journal in New York. This is a smaller newspaper. It does not probably have a lot of science writers, a lot of mental health experts on staff. And what this paper did in the day after the shooting was contact a local autism care center in a neighboring town, one that's highly respected nationwide. And all of the experts there were able to provide valuable context.
Curtis, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Curtis Brainerd covers science journalism for the Columbia Journalism Review. We contacted ABC News about the disappearing information in their blog post. They did not provide a comment. It's perhaps natural in the anguish and shock following such episodes as the Newtown shootings that some portion of the public's anger is directed at the messenger. Why are the media using the shooter's name and glorifying him, people ask? Why must they run these images over and over? And why in God's name are they interviewing children? On message boards, comment sections, blogs, and tweets, Americans are decrying the use of children as interview subjects. On Huffington Post this week, we've seen such comments as, "The media who interview these children have absolutely no compassion and no brains," all caps. But not everybody sees it that way. Bill Ritter is a news anchor for WABC-TV in New York and a correspondent for 2020. Bill, welcome to OTM.
Bob, nice to be here. It's an interesting topic you've chosen.
I want to play you a piece of tape from Donna Gaffney, a psychologist who specializes in child trauma and who has often been used as a consultant for news media in best practices.
There's no reason for them to be interviewed. There's no value to it. There's no benefit to it. Kids have to be with people that they love and they care about, and they have to be safe after an incident like this. This doesn't provide that.
Is she wrong, Bill?
Well, in an ideal world, she's not wrong, but they were witnesses to something huge and, yes, horrifying, but also a big news story. And they were the first witnesses there. We did not just approach children, but if their parents were there, we said we would like to talk to them if they would, if you would agree to it. You know, we got a lot of criticism, but you hear the criticism louder than you do the people who are comforted by our coverage. A lot of people watched us on Friday and Saturday and Sunday and Monday because they wanted information. And it has sparked, as we've seen, a national discussion about just a whole range of issues, from guns to mental illness to security at school.
I don't know what was on WABC's air, but what I took note especially of was interviews of kids who had been huddled in the corner of a gymnasium. And their testimony was about how many pops they heard from the automatic weapon discharging. What do we learn as an audience from that about what took place versus just the emotion of seeing children recount what they heard?
Why did we talk to people who managed to escape the World Trade Center? Because they were there in this incredible and horrific experience. If it's gratuitous, I would agree. I think that we open ourselves up for extreme criticism. But if it gives insight into what these people were hearing and feeling, you know, that gives insight into some answers and some solutions so that this kind of stuff doesn't happen again. And I think that we're parents here. We're people here, too. We feel that. When we see something that makes the viewers cringe, it makes us cringe, too.
There's a big body of research that says that eyewitnesses are actually poor witnesses. And especially so with children, that their memories are quite chaotic, particularly amid the trauma of an episode like this. And not only do you risk further emotional damage to the child, you're not even necessarily getting the straight story.
Well, I think that's true no matter what the age. People have vastly different recollections of what they each saw of the same incident. Out of all this, you know, emerges some sort of quilt that you can't piece together what happened. And I think that's what happened here, because eventually, hours later, we did have a pretty good picture of what happened.
I think every child I saw interviewed was quite composed. No sobbing, shaking, trembling, the things we associate with a kid in pain. I assume that if a kid breaks down in the middle of an interview, you're just not going to use that tape, correct?
We're extremely sensitive to what we're getting on tape. Did you think that it went overboard? Do you think that it was too much?
I don't think we should use kids, except under the most dire circumstances. But the reason I asked that, Bill, is if we can be pretty sure that we're not going to see tape of kids breaking down on camera, how are we to know that there wasn't tape just like that gathered but not aired?
I didn't see any tape of a kid breaking down. And if we had it, I'm not aware of a decision to use it or not to use it. This was not wall-to-wall children. We had a couple sound bites from children on our air who were there and who escaped and who felt the trauma of what was going on, and we did ask their parents' permission. This was not the story that we reported from the child's point of view. And some people let us know quickly and many times when we did air a sound bite from a child that they didn't like that.
In this inquisition, I focused on whether it's exploitative of the kids to be interviewed. But I wonder about the audience. Is it fair to them to trot out a child at a murder scene that left 20 children dead?
We could ask that of every story we cover. Is it fair to show, you know, a crashed car? We had the Long Island Expressway shut down for 15 hours from Wednesday into Thursday. A 33-car pileup that killed someone and had a couple people critically injured. Should we not show that because it's bad? You know, or does it show, hey, you know, this is what happens when you don't drive carefully. This is what happens when you're speeding. This is what happens when you're texting while driving or making a phone call or distracted. And it's the same logic that says, you know, we shouldn't talk about the shooter and shouldn't find out what made him tick and shouldn't find out why he was led to do this. I think that we owe it to the viewers to dig as deep as possible and find out why this happened.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Bill Ritter is a news anchor for WABC in New York City. Donna Gaffney, the other voice you heard, is a childhood trauma expert and a faculty member in the New York University International Trauma Studies Program. Last Thursday, just a few weeks before the looming fiscal cliff, the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service, Congress's authoritative source of objective policy analysis, released a potentially game-changing report. It rejected a fundamental dogma of the Republican Party, namely that lower top marginal tax rates correlate with economic growth. Democrats trumpeted the findings at a press conference, while Republicans, like Orrin Hatch spokeswoman Antonia Ferrier, accused Democrats of, quote, doing a bizarre victory dance. What's really bizarre is that this is the second time the Congressional Research Service has released this report. The CRS actually withdrew it after it was first published in September when Republican staffers accused it of using flawed methodology and partisan language. This new version, according to Roll Call reporter Emma Dumain, basically draws the same conclusions. The only difference, she says, is that it further explains its methodology and softens some of the language that so irked the GOP.
Instead of Bush tax cuts, we now see Bush-era tax cuts. Instead of millionaires, we see high-income taxpayers.
Is this the first time that CRS has been accused of partisanship or of incautious language?
This was the latest in watershed moments for this agency. In 2004, a CRS analyst named Louis Fisher wrote an article for an outside publication that took a personal stance on the Iraq War. It did not side with Democrats or Republicans, but it took a position on what was a very politically charged issue at the time. It sparked then-CRS director Daniel Mulholland to issue a statement about the importance of behaving in a way that didn't call into question the nonpartisan nature of the CRS. The last time we really saw this in the mainstream media, not just in the Beltway, was Morris Davis, who was a former Guantanamo Bay Military Commission's prosecutor, who was fired from the CRS in 2009 after writing a Wall Street Journal opinion piece that was critical of Obama's policy on detainees.
As far back as 1995, House Speaker Newt Gingrich tried to do approximately to the CRS and to other congressional research agencies what he tried to do with public broadcasting, not necessarily to zero it out, but to cut them. You've suggested that the threat of budget cuts was chilling.
That's when analysts inside started to think about not offering robust, deep, heavy
analysis?
Analysis, exactly, but lists of facts.
But aren't these agencies chartered to do that analysis, to draw policy conclusions based on available facts?
That's what makes this so complicated. Our expectations for what the Congressional Research Service should be and what lawmakers would like it to be and what analysts see their role being very much in conflict. And Tom Hungerford, the author of this report, denies that this report is in any way biased or partisan. But he does believe that he has a responsibility to do an analysis.
Seeing that the author Hungerford had made multiple campaign donations to the Democrats, can the CRS be nonpartisan if its employees, and particularly the author of this report, are active party members?
So I raised this question to analysts from the CRS, and they say, how dare anybody call into question my integrity as a professional and my ability to leave my politics at the door?
What amazes me is that in its substance, it's a blockbuster, a repudiation of the supply-side economics that the Republicans have depended on for several generations. And yet what little coverage it's gotten has been about the withdraw and reissue, not about the conclusions themselves. In short, what?
The odds are stacked against this, I think, from the start. Because the report was removed and then reissued, it does have a very politically charged taint to it. So even if Democrats were to go around waving this, saying, look at this, look at what this does, you already had Republicans bashing not its findings so much as its very integrity.
Here we are facing the fiscal cliff where tax rates are at the very center of the debate. So, do you believe that the press missed something fairly titanic in the CRS's conclusions?
The report's findings were made secondary to the brouhaha surrounding it. To their credit, Democrats tried very hard last week to make this not about the controversy surrounding the report. Sander Levin, who is the Michigan Democrat ranking member on the House Ways and Means Committee, he held a press conference when this was reissued last week with some of his senior Democratic counterparts. And Chris Van Hollen, the top Democrat on the Budget Committee, said this report drives a stake through the heart of Republican economic theory. They all said this report shows we must increase taxes on the wealthy, a plan that Americans essentially voted for in November. They tried. It was a sparsely attended affair. Not a lot of press showed up. Not a lot of people wrote about it.
Emma, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Emma Dumain is a reporter for Roll Call in Washington, D.C. Coming up, once rejected Supreme Court Justice nominee Robert Bork died this week. We'll look at how his name became a verb. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Robert Heron Bork died this week. Mr. Bork is probably best known as a legal scholar and a U.S. Circuit Court judge who for just a few months was thrust into the spotlight when he was nominated for the Supreme Court back in July 1987. But he's also known, as Brooke observed a few years back, for being a verb.
As we watch a major political event, we naturally consider political language. And in recent years, the singular locution to come out of a Senate confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court judge is to bork.
To bork means what?
I think to attack a person's reputation and views unfairly.
That was Robert Bork. His nomination went up in flames in 1987. The process whereby has since been dubbed borking, especially by the political right, which essentially owns the word, defined by Webster's to wit, bork, to seek to obstruct a political appointment or selection, also to attack a political opponent viciously. Not so, say the liberals. In the Washington Post, Stephanie Cutter, an aide to Senator Edward Kennedy, declared, "If borked means fulfilling your constitutional duty by protecting the rights and freedoms of the American people, then every senator should wear that as a badge of honor." And it should be noted that if Bork himself was the proto-Borky, then during his confirmation hearings, Kennedy was the Borker. Many personal names have fathered nouns. There's Boycott and Braille, Diesel, Dunce, Maverick, and Stroganoff, and all those compound words like Ponzi scheme and Pullman car, Hobson's choice, and graham cracker. Adjectives are similarly abundant. Darwinian, Orwellian, Draconian, Kafkaesque, or sadistic. But when it came to verbs, we could scarcely find one without the suffix I-Z-E, as in galvanize or mesmerize, bowdlerize or pasteurize. Was there another name, just a name like Bork, with no grammatical frippery that was ever used as a verb? In recent history, we could find only one, to Bobbit, which means to cut off a man's penis, named for Lorena Bobbit, who Webster reminds us did such to her abusive husband in 1994. Now, Bork sees himself as a victim of injustice, and to Bork as a monument to martyrdom.
My name became a verb, and I regard that as one form of immortality.
I don't know if John Bobbit feels that way.
It's no big news that new technology is menacing traditional media, but not for the first time. In the 60s, computer-generated cold type began doing to thousands of linotype operators what Gutenberg's press had done to scribes. Nowhere did the revolution play out more dramatically than in New York City, where 50 years ago this month, the threat of cold type led a consortium of labor unions to strike. New York's 7 daily newspapers were closed for 114 days to devastating effect. Scott Sherman wrote about the strike in a web exclusive for Vanity Fair titled The Long Goodbye. He describes pre-1962 New York as a thriving newspaper town in which multiple editions of 7 newspapers rolled off the presses throughout the day. Of the 7, the 3 papers that survived the strike were The Times, The Daily News, and The Post, which, as Sherman points out, was then in a pre-Murdoch incarnation.
The Post was a liberal crusading paper. It went after Joe McCarthy. It went after Richard Nixon. So I think that was the paper that crossed class boundaries more than the others did. Upper class educated people read the New York Times and the New York Herald Tribune. There were 2 mass market morning tabloids with powerful working class readerships, the Daily News and the New York Daily Mirror. And then you had 2 afternoon broadsheets, the Hearthstone New York Journal American and the World Telegram and Sun.
The linotype machine was this enormous apparatus that had a keyboard, and it would lay individual letters mechanically, and then they would be molded with hot lead into the type that created the impression on the newspaper. How many people did it take to operate?
It took 1 skilled man to operate it, but it took a number of other people to maintain it. In the 1950s, newspaper publishers, especially at non-union papers like the Los Angeles Times, began to import into their composing rooms cutting-edge computerized typesetting equipment. This created enormous anxiety in the International Typographical Union, the ITU. It had 120,000 members in 600 locals. It was incredibly clean, it was incredibly democratic, and it was incredibly militant.
The head of the union at the time, Bertram Powers, believed that he had enough economic leverage to prevent the onward march of technology. What could have possibly made him think that he could impose the status quo on these powerful publishers?
In our own time, labor unions are weak, but the story I've written took place in the early 1960s, and many of the members of the union were hardcore militant labor men. 120,000 ITU members around the country voted to give 3% of their weekly paychecks to a strike fund, and that enabled Bert Powers and the ITU to have all the money they needed for the 62-63 strike.
With hindsight, though, we can see that Powers was maybe the ultimate Luddite. He believed that you could stop the march of industrial progress.
At the center of the strike was really fear of technology and fear of computers. The International Typographical Union got a pay raise at the end of the strike, but they granted the publishers the right to bring computerized typesetting into the newspaper composing rooms. They won the strike but they lost the war.
Now, this was 1962. Obviously, no internet, no cable news. Three or four TV stations, radio stations, almost all in a music format. What happens to a city like New York when it loses all seven of its newspapers in one fell swoop and loses them for 4 months?
Nora Ephron, who got her start during the strike, as did Jimmy Breslin and Gay Talese, told me that it was like the city's lifeblood was cut off. Attendance at funerals declined. People did not know when their friends died.
Broadway went dark. Charities lost donations.
There were civil rights implications because the Congress on Racial Equality Corps was leading a boycott against the Seal Test Milk Company. And without the newspapers to publicize this, the boycott was undermined. The city's fight against slumlords was undermined. The building commissioner commented at the time, quote, there's a distinct difference between a $500 fine and a $500 fine plus a story in the Times.
Of course, 114 days without advertising revenue did harm to all of the properties, and some of them irreparable harm. Tell me what the strike did to the newspapers that were on the edge to begin with.
The only newspaper that was economically strong in the early 60s in New York was the mighty New York Times. Its principal competitor, the New York Herald Tribune, was greatly weakened by the strike. After the strike was settled, the Times and the Herald Tribune each had to raise their cover price from a nickel to a dime. And because of the settlement of the strike, which led to higher wages for the printers, the Herald Tribune came back to the streets with a much more precarious balance sheet. And so the strike contributed to the death of the Herald Tribune in 1967. And a few months after the strike, the Mirror, which was a morning competitor to the Daily News, that folded.
But there were some silver linings to this cloud. You made reference to the literary figures whose careers really took off when they had no daily newspaper job to go to.
Correct. Reporters faced a choice. They could march on a picket line and get strike pay, or they could start freelancing. And in the case of Nora Ephron, Pete Hamill, Tom Wolfe, and Gay Talese, they used the opportunity to begin careers as freelance journalists. Talese and Wolfe claimed that the strike was central to their careers because it got them writing long-form pieces for magazines. The other thing that happened is with the New York Times not available, people who looked for book reviews had no New York Times Sunday book review. So a small group of intellectuals on the Upper West Side, led by Robert Silvers and Robert Lowell and others, took the opportunity to create a biweekly literary periodical, the New York Review of Books.
And television news, which in 1962 was scarcely developed as a medium, also benefited. Can you tell me how it filled the vacuum left by the newspaper strike?
Most of the local television stations added significant amounts of money to their news budget, and they hired large numbers of reporters. And after the strike ended in the spring of 63, many people who read newspapers never went back to newspapers. They stayed with the local TV news.
Well, if cold type was the sword of Damocles to the typographers in 1962, the internet is the same for traditional newspaper employees in 2012. Is there any force out there now that's the equivalent of local number six of the ITU?
For better or worse, we don't have a Burt Powers on the scene. Newspaper employees are more or less defenseless. And it may turn out that the digital newspaper world that's coming, a largely union-free landscape, could turn out to be more exhilarating than the 1960s. But I'm nostalgic about the fact that the thud of the newspaper on our front steps in the morning won't be there.
Scott, thank you.
Bob, thank you.
Scott Sherman is a contributing writer for The Nation. You can read his web exclusive about the printer strike at vanityfair.com. And now a word from our sponsors.
Removing dishes while cooking can be too hot to handle. Ouch! The Of Glove. Now with non-slip silicone grips. The Of Glove.
Mama Lucia on a roll. Mama Lucia on a plate. Mama Lucia meatballs. Have a taste that's really great.
Mama Lucia meatballs, America's favorite.
Needless to say, we're not actually sponsored by the Of Glove or Mama Lucia. We played those ads to illustrate the point of our next story, which is that compared to the content of our show, those ads probably blared out of your radio or MP3 player at jarringly high volume. Well, when we originally aired the next interview in 2010, Congress had just approved legislation that would require television advertisers to turn down the volume. The Commercial Advertising Loudness Mitigation, or CALM, Act would keep TV ads from being louder than the surrounding programs, following the standards set by the United Nations of all institutions. The CALM Act passed in 2010, but it didn't go into effect until last week. The Wall Street Journal's Elizabeth Williamson has been following CALM. Elizabeth, welcome to OTM.
It's nice to be here, Bob.
I have to tell you, this is a very, very personal subject for me because I live in a household where I am held personally responsible for all that ails the universe, you know, whether it's sunspots or terrorism or the volume of a TV commercial suddenly getting very loud and disturbing the household. I get the fisheye, Garfield, turn that down. I have to assume that others have been bedeviled by this for a long time.
Indeed, they have. For 50 years, people have complained to the Federal Communications Commission about the loudness of their television ads. And the FCC, after 1984 or so, discovered the mute button and recommended that people use that.
The mute button, yeah, but, you know, that requires a lot of proactive participation and a fundamentally passive exercise, TV watching. Why has the government deemed it my responsibility to preempt the wall of sound that hits me when the commercial break begins?
At the time when they were really recommending the mute button, and they still do that, they were in a deregulatory mode, so they didn't really want to be in charge of regulating the sound of TV commercials. But really, the answer is more technological. People perceive sound differently depending on how old they are, depending on the technology the sound is coming out of, depending on whether it's conversation or other forms of noise.
I have to say that my personal experience is that the increase in volume is so abrupt that it's hard to believe that the peak volume of the commercial matches anything that I've just heard in the actual programming that preceded it.
When the engineers create these ads, the peak sound in the programming adjacent to the commercial had to be just slightly louder than the constant sound of the commercial. So what would happen would be you'd have a cop show, for example, and you'd have a bomb blast and then the bit of quiet dialogue. And then all of a sudden, you'd have an ad that the entire volume of the ad was geared to the bomb explosion that you just heard. So it really would blast you off the couch.
And then the subsequent advertiser has to outvolume the previous advertiser and turns the dial from, you know, 10 and a half to 11.
They'd all try and outgun each other. And what had happened in the United States is that people had switched to digital. And you can pump a lot of sound down a digital signal without distortion. So you had crystal clear, really loud sound and thousands of complaints coming into the FCC.
Technical issues had made this kind of a tough nut to crack, but Congress cracked it this time. What changed?
The technology changed. People generally agreed on what constitutes loudness in human conversation. You could determine a loud voice from one that was comfortable for you to hear. But when it came to other types of noises, people varied widely. So what they decided to do was to create a machine that could average out sound based on what's comfortable for conversation. Because if people have a level of comfortability with the loudness of conversation, then the ads should be based on that.
This has got to be the safest, the most popular piece of legislation that's come out of Congress since the mortgage interest deduction.
Yeah. Anna Eshoo of California, Democrat from Silicon Valley, took this up because her elderly parents were with her and they cranked the TV and were blowing her out of her own home with the TV ads. So she pushed this legislation. She says that people are stopping her in the gas station, in the grocery store, on the street in her district, and thanking her for this.
This is a woman who probably now could vote for cutting Social Security and Medicare benefits and maybe for declaring war against Rhode Island and still get reelected.
Pretty close, according to Representative Eshoo. She says that if she had saved 50 million children from some malady, she would probably generate less thanks than she has by pushing this legislation.
This was the rare bit of bipartisanship and, you know, Republican-Democratic kumbaya in the halls of Congress. But there was a moment when it wasn't all so bipartisan-y.
There was some floor debate. The Republican critics of this bill thought that this was an unnecessary intrusion by the federal government into the private sector and private life. A couple of the legislators stood up and said, "Now, if we regulate the loudness of TV ads, what's next? What's the ridiculous extreme we could reach here? We could wind up regulating the types of things that are even advertised on TV." And of course, it was pointed out to them that, well, we have already done that.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
Elizabeth Williamson is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Free Crazy Eddie t-shirts, free Crazy Eddie baseball caps today through Sunday, 999 3rd Avenue between 59th and 60th in Manhattan. Go there today!
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Krista Ripple and Annie Russell. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. No guarantees about her voice.
I'm working on it.
We shall see. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.